This is where we live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Students are counting the days until school's out for the summer. But then what? We'll check in with the New Haven School District about the kinds of activities available to keep kids from losing what they've learned over the last 10 months. It's known as the summer slide. That conversation later. First, a summer ritual for many Americans is heading to the pool. But not everyone has a pool or even knows how to swim. Minority children are more likely to not know how to swim. A USA Swimming Foundation study last year found more than 6 out of 10 African-American children can't swim. Nearly 5 out of 10 Hispanic or Latino kids don't know how to swim. And today we're taking a closer look at this disparity. Coming up, we'll hear from a community nonprofit about a program that's confronting this problem, and we'll find out whether it's making an impact in the New Haven community. Now, do you know how to swim? Did your parents? And if you never learned, we want to know why. The number 860-275-7266. You can email us where we live at WMPR.org and find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. We also wanted to know how the history of segregation in the U.S. contributed to disparities in swimming today. And so on with us from Montana Public Radio is Jeff Wiltsey, professor of history at University of Montana and author of the book Contested Waters, A Social History of Swimming Pools in America. Jeff, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
I mentioned swimming is largely seen as a summer activity. At the same time, there are many Americans who don't know how to swim or have not very good swimming skills. The CDC, the American Academy of Pediatrics, also says drowning is the second leading cause of death among children. And we're also seeing statistics that I mentioned that this disparity and lack of swimming disproportionately affects children of color. In your research, why is that? Walk us through the numbers that we see today, and then we'll learn a little bit about the history.
Sure. In general, black Americans are half as likely to know how to swim as white Americans, and black children are about 3 times more likely to drown than white children. And so the question becomes, why is that? I mean, this is a significant disparity in both swimming and drowning rates across this social line. And studies have oftentimes focused on kind of contemporary social and cultural explanations, such as fear of water, parents not swimming, perceptions that swimming is a white sport. And so in my research, what I've done is ask the question, well, what accounts for this? I mean, what accounts for the fact that that African-American adults are less likely to swim than white adults? What accounts for the perception that swimming is a white sport, a white activity? What accounts for the greater levels of fear generally of water among African-Americans and among white Americans? And to my mind, the primary explanation for this is what's happened in the past, and that it's past discrimination in access to swimming pools, swim lessons, and swim teams, such that large numbers, a widespread part of white Americans sort of learned to swim historically during the 20th century, and parents have then passed that on to their children, whereas because of restricted access to swimming pools and swim lessons, that swimming never became as broadly common or popular among African Americans, and thus it hasn't been passed down generationally and generationally as widespread as it has among whites.
Now, Jeff, in your book, you look at the history again. You mentioned the 20th century. Talk about how swimming, how it first became seen as this national pastime, and when you saw the surge of swimming pools being built.
Yeah, it's worth starting out with understanding that research has shown that during the 19th century and the very early 20th century, that people of African ancestry throughout the Americas were more accomplished swimmers than people of European ancestry. And so that people of European ancestry becoming more accomplished swimmers is a relatively recent phenomenon. And it's really something that developed during the 20th century as a consequence of the building of swimming pools and access to those swimming pools. Prior to the 1920s, there weren't that many swimming pools in the United States, and swimming was not a broadly popular or common activity. But then during the 1920s and 1930s, cities throughout the country built literally thousands of swimming pools. And many of these swimming pools were large leisure resort pools that many of them were larger than football fields. We've kind of lost track of these grand leisure resort pools today because so many of them have been closed down. But there were thousands of pools during the 1920s and 1930s, and they were generally open to whites. But because of racial discrimination, segregation, in some cases outright exclusion, Black Americans had far more restricted access to these public pools. Mm-hmm. And so many, many fewer as a percentage Black Americans sort of learned to swim, and swimming didn't become as common a part of the recreational culture during this period when it surged in popularities among white Americans. And then the same pattern was repeated itself again during the 1950s and 1960s. There were literally tens of thousands of private club pools that were developed out in suburbs around the United States. And if the earlier public pools were restricted to Black Americans, the tens of thousands of private club pools developed during the post-World War II period were almost entirely off limits to Black Americans. And so once again, white Americans, in this case mostly middle-class Americans, had easy access to appealing swimming pools where they would go day after day during the summer. They would join swim teams, whereas Black Americans did not have access to these pools where swimming became, again, broadly popularized.
When you talk about the swimming pools being built in many cities starting in the 20s, where did that interest come from? And in the beginning, did you see these pools separated by gender and before it became an issue among racial lines?
Yeah, a primary impetus for the pool building during the 1920s and 1930s was to promote a community life that public officials, when you go back and read their intentions and thinking about building these giant resort pools, that they wanted these pools to promote a vibrant community life. And they also had a very family focus in mind, where they wanted these pools to be accessible to families, so mother, father, children could all go to the pool together. And so what that necessitated was gender integration. And so prior to the 1920s, what pools there were, and there weren't a lot of pools, but what pools there were strictly segregated along gender lines because of the intimacy involved in their use. And so males and females would either use separate pools or they would use the same pool but at different times. But during the 1920s, as city officials wanted to promote a vibrant community life, wanted to promote family sociability, they then gender integrated the pools so families could go together and swim together. And that's the point at which, at least in the North and also in border state cities like St. Louis and Washington, D.C. and Baltimore, that they imposed racial segregation. And so prior to gender integration, Blacks and whites swam together. I mean, in my research in New York, in Boston, Pittsburgh, Chicago, lots and lots of cities, I found that prior to gender integration, Blacks and whites swam together. But then once cities allowed males and females to swim together, that's when white swimmers and public officials within those cities sort of segregated pools along racial lines. In large part because they didn't want Black men interacting with white women at such intimate spaces.
Jeff Wiltsey is author of Contested Waters, A Social History of Swimming Pools in America, joining us today from Montana Public Radio. As we talk about swimming disparities that exist in our country today, we're looking at the history of where some of those disparities have come from, and one being how swimming pools were segregated and they weren't accessible to Black Americans in the 20th century. In the South, we know under Jim Crow, official segregation was law of the land. But I want you to talk a little bit about some of the anecdotes and incidents that you uncovered in your research in places like Pittsburgh, where you saw violent encounters at pools when Blacks wanted to swim at the same place where white Pittsburghers wanted to swim.
Yeah, ironically, or perhaps paradoxically, it was in more northern cities where racial segregation was not official city or state policy, that violence occurred. And so Pennsylvania actually had a civil rights law that prohibited racial discrimination and access to public facilities. And so Pittsburgh as a city couldn't really impose an official policy of racial segregation. And yet in 1931, when it opened a gigantic outdoor pool in Highland Park, this was the first pool that was gender integrated. And so previously, there's good evidence from the Pittsburgh Courier, the African-American newspaper in Pittsburgh, that blacks and whites swam together at the gender segregated pools with little problem. But then in 1931, Pittsburgh opens a giant outdoor pool and allows males and females to use it together, but they could not impose an official policy of racial segregation. And so they effectively left it to white swimmers who would literally attack any black swimmers that came to use the pool. And typically this was young African-American men, teenagers, 15, 16, 17 years old, who would come to this pool, this giant pool. There'd be hundreds, in some cases thousands of white swimmers there who would intimidate them. But if they persisted and entered the pool, they would be punched and dunked under the water and kicked. And that this was the means, intimidation and violence, that was used to impose de facto segregation at these pools.
Eventually, courts ruled that you couldn't segregate and keep people away from using these pools if they weren't white. And so then what did we see happen in the 50s and 60s, Jeff?
Yeah, racial desegregation of public pools began in the late 1940s. And then really continued to the 1960s. And so it began in some northern cities in the late 1940s. And then by the mid-1950s, most public pools in the North had been racially desegregated. And then that shifts to the South during the early 1960s. And the response was in the South very blatant, that in the southern United States, cities just closed pools. Closed all their public pools rather than allow mixed race use. And so in many southern cities, in many areas of the South, there were literally no public pools after racial desegregation because cities just simply closed them down. In the North, the response was more nuanced, that typically what happened in the North is when a pool that had previously been for whites only became racially desegregated and black swimmers started to use it, that white swimmers in mass abandoned it. Mm-hmm. I found in case after case after case that white attendance at a pool that had become racially desegregated would drop by 90 or 95% when black swimmers started using it. And so overall usage of many of these pools, especially these large resort pools that I talked about previously, that they started to attract relatively few swimmers. And so cities stop investing money in them and maintaining them. And so over time, very quickly actually, over the course in many cases of just a few years, the pools became dilapidated, they required significant maintenance, and cities simply refused to pay the costs of maintaining them or rebuilding them, and so ended up closing them down. And so what happens during the 1960s and 70s in particular is a mass wave of pool closings, public pool closings, which again, so African Americans and other people of color get access to pools in the wake of desegregation. But on the heels then of that access, many of these pools get shut down, which again reinforces their restricted access as whites are able generally to swim at private pools.
So when you see these pools closing, a lack of access to black Americans to even be at a pool or learn how to swim, so this then led into this a lack of culture of swimming, where you had generations who never learned to swim, so it wasn't something that they then tried to get their children to learn?
Exactly. That's how I understand it. I mean, that's how I explain it. And to me, the important idea is that I think for many people, they think that what happened in the past is in the past and it doesn't directly influence what's happening today. And that's certainly not the case here, that the past discrimination continues to shape swimming and drowning rates today, precisely because swimming is essentially a cultural practice, or it's a cultural habit. And you can think about it in generational terms, that if you grow up going to a pool and it's an important part of your upbringing, you then tend to pass that along or create those same opportunities for your children. And then your children do it for their children. And so these cultural practices like swimming, either competitive swimming or recreational swimming, get passed on generationally, generationally. Well, if you as a child did not swim, and instead you grew up more generally with a fear of water and a sense that swimming pools were not a place where you belonged, then you obviously didn't take your children to the swimming pool. And then that fear of water or that sense of not belonging at a pool gets passed down from generationally to generationally. And that's what we find among many Black families.
Mm-hmm. This is Where We Live. Again, today we're looking at swimming culture and disparities where there are minority children who don't know how to swim compared to white children. When we're talking about how this leads to some outcomes and stories we're seeing today, Jeff, there was that highly publicized case in Louisiana back in 2010 known as the Red River Tragedy. You've also written about this. Tell our listeners briefly what happened there.
Yeah, it's a tragic story that highlights the disparities that we're talking about, which is one young African-American man, a teenager, waded out into the Rouge River in Louisiana and essentially stepped off a ledge where he went into deep water that was over his head, and he couldn't swim. And so he started flailing about and saying, "Help me, help me, help me." And he was there with a larger family party. And several of his cousins sort of rushed out just instinctively to try to save them. And they went off this ledge as well into deep water, and none of them could swim. And the adults were standing along the shoreline watching their children drown, but they couldn't do anything to help because they couldn't swim either. And finally, someone from afar heard the screaming, came and ran, jumped into the water, and pulled one of the children out. And it was the original young man who was the original one to start drowning. But then all of his, or the cousins of his that went in to save him, drowned. And I can't remember the exact number, but I think it was 6 or 7 young African Americans drowned because no one within this larger family knew how to swim.
Today, when we look at neighborhoods and cities, there aren't a lot of community pools anymore. And after the recession, Jeff, have we seen even municipalities taking an interest in trying to spend the money to have this pool in their neighborhoods, so to increase access for all children, not just the children who have families that can afford swim lessons or a membership to a private club?
My sense, and this is mostly anecdotal, is that there has been a resurgence of funding for public water recreation over maybe the last 10 years or so. So coming out of the so-called Great Recession. Now, what's different from the past is that a lot of these facilities are water parks where they're not traditional swimming pools, but they are like lily pads and sprays, and you'd maybe wade out to your waist or to your knees. And so they're providing a nice summertime recreation, escape from the heat, but they're not serving the same social or life-saving purpose as swimming pools used to, because a lot of these facilities don't actually involve much swimming. Mm.
And then going forward, Jeff, we were talking about the history of discrimination and segregation in this country, being one of the consequences of the disparities we see today in the ability for some Americans to be able to swim. But when we look at the economic barriers and the socioeconomic factors that may lead people to not be able to have access, is that a bigger issue today?
I think it is, continues to be a big issue, but it's now splitting along a different social line, which is now access to swimming pools is less sort of restricted along strictly racial lines, and it's more now restricted along class lines, such that middle and upper class Americans of whatever racial identity have easier access to swimming pools, swim lessons, and swim teams than do poor and working class Americans. And that's a consequence of the general trend towards privatization. Now, I just mentioned that over the last 10 years, there's been something of a resurgence of funding of public water recreation. But for a long period of time, pools were shut down, relatively new public pools were opened, and that instead, the new pools that were opened were private pools. And so now, within the United States, we have large numbers of private pools that if you have the money, you can easily access them, where we still have a relative dearth of public pools. And so if you need to access public recreation, you're far less likely to be able to access a pool than if you can afford to access a private pool. And so kind of casting forward in time 15, 20 years from now, I think what we're going to find is that the swimming and drowning disparities that exist in the United States will start to show more clearly along class lines than along racial lines. But to the extent to which people of color are overrepresented among the poor and working classes in America, we'll still see a racial dynamic to it.
Jeff Wildsey is professor of history at University of Montana, author of Contested Waters, A Social History of Swimming Pools in America. Jeff joined us today from the studios of Montana Public Radio. Jeff, thank you so much for joining us.
It was my pleasure.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Today, we've been learning about why minority children are more likely to drown than white children, first taking a look at the history in our country. But now we want to focus on the programs that are working to change some of these startling statistics. We're going to hear more after the break, and we want to hear from you, too. Does your community have a public pool where children can learn to swim? Or is the onus on parents to pay for lessons at a private pool? We want to hear from you. 860-275-7266. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. We just heard from historian Jeff Wildsey about why segregation at pools in the United States is one of the reasons that's led to disparities in swimming ability among African Americans. Now, there are programs working to confront this problem to help all children learn to swim. LEAP in New Haven is one of them. Joining us now by phone, Henry Fernandez, executive director of LEAP in New Haven. Henry, welcome to the show.
Oh, great to be here, Lucy.
So tell me a little bit about LEAP, and specifically, what kind of swimming programs do you have there for children and families in New Haven?
Absolutely. So we teach about 300 kids to swim every year for free. We do that through after-school programs and as part of our summer camp as well. The children that we serve are low-income children, by and large, and overwhelmingly Black and Latino. We're very excited because not only do we teach kids to swim, but we also train lifeguards and swim instructors, also from our community, also primarily African-American and Latino, because we think it's really important that, we can provide jobs in the community through our swim program, but then also, it allows us to have really great role models for the kids that we're teaching to swim so that they see that swimming is something that African Americans and Latinos have a long history in, including Olympians who are like Simone Emanuel, who's recently won gold. So we're very excited about it. It's part of our bigger programs that serve about 1,200 kids a year that are very literacy focused and do lots of other great activities with kids. But swimming's hugely important, and I think having the show and the professor that you just had on to talk about why it is that we have this tremendous gap in terms of who swims in the United States and what some of the horrible implications around drowning can be if we don't teach all kids to swim.
Two of your staff are in studio with me. I wanted to welcome them. Albert Eden, LEAP's Youth Development and Aquatics Director, and Nazir Peters, lifeguard and swim instructor with LEAP, also a sophomore at UConn. Albert and Nazir, welcome to Where We Live.
Hello, welcome. Thank you.
How you doing, Lucy? Great to be here.
I'll start here with Albert. Again, you're the aquatics director at LEAP, also director of youth development. You grew up in the city, so I'm in New York City. So I'm curious about what led you to have an interest in swimming, and when did you learn?
Well, I learned at a young age, about middle school, high school. Took me about 10 years to build that confidence. Had an experience as a five-year-old. Was kind of just thrown in the pool by one of my uncles, and it was tough. I didn't know how to swim. I was flailing in the water, and I was like, okay, let's check this off the list.
That sounds like that might resonate with some of us who've also experienced that way of trying to learn how to swim when an adult decides, well, the only way to learn is mm-hmm. by throwing you in. That's actually, I think, the worst way to instill fear. When we were talking with the historian about the lack of community pools and access around this country for many decades, I'm curious, what were your reaction to hearing that and what you saw growing up in New York City?
Yeah, it was true. So coming from New York, we had a few community pools, which just so happened to be in the urban environments, particularly in the projects. Gated pools, no lifeguards, pretty much just a space for people to stand in a pool, sit around, really likely to drown or be traumatized or, increase their fears. Because they didn't have the ability to be taught how to swim. And growing up in New York, I didn't know where else to swim other than just the community pool.
Mm-hmm. So the kids that are coming to LEAP now for the aquatics program, what brought them there? And when we talk about generations of having family members who may not have been swimmers, what is the impetus that's getting parents to think that this might be something their child needs to know?
Well, it's an important skill. Families travel. Friends have friends who have pools in their backyards. It's water. When it's hot, people want to jump in the water. And Philippe, it's been a tremendous focus. I know the pool closed in 2009 due to funding. However, when our executive director, Henry Fernandez, started his new term there, it was a goal. We're going to open this pool up. We're going to teach these kids how to swim. And parents realize there's a place to bring their kids to learn how to swim and be safe in the water and have fun. And LEAP's mission with that has been to teach as many kids as possible to swim and then have young kids who look like them, high school seniors, juniors, and also college students to be their mentors in the pools.
One of those mentors is here, Nazir Peters, again, a lifeguard and swim instructor with LEAP, also a sophomore at UConn. Nazir, tell us what introduced you to swimming.
Well, actually, I started off swimming at a very young age at Conti West Hills Magnet School, and we had a pool there. I was taught how to swim, and about at the age of 14, 15, I was LIT at LEAP, and I was taught by one of the lifeguards there, head lifeguard actually, Devin Perez, and he actually perfected the skills that I thought I learned in middle school, which ultimately made me a better swimmer and who I am today.
So talk a little bit more about that, because you said that you learned to swim earlier, but then you really got skills to be a strong swimmer. Now you're a lifeguard. I think that's interesting because I think a question that some parents have is when they sign their kids up for swimming, they learn basic swimming, and then it's, how long should you keep going with those lessons? I'm just curious, when you talk about learning to be a better swimmer, what was it about your mentor that helped you do that?
It was a process, really. It was a long, long road, kind of. When I went in there, I thought I knew it all, but he thought otherwise. So he had me doing like very intense training. So coming in, maybe doing 10 to 15 laps, outside exercises such as like push-ups, sit-ups, and then maybe doing a few laps around the pool just to like get me used to like swimming fast, basically, mm-hmm. and being a great swimmer.
And when you're helping teach young girls and boys to swim at LEAP, what are the questions they have or the fears they have?
Well, a lot of them come in not even wanting to get in the pool. Like, they come from backgrounds like where they don't know how to swim. Sometimes I get kids that come in the pool, and it's actually their first time ever being in a pool. So it's like it's a good thing for me to like see that they're from one situation, and then after they leave the pool, they're like, I'm not ready to go. Like, what class is over already? No, we can't leave. So,
Albert, when you hear these stories and you hear from parents and kids, it's very likely the same thing where they're afraid to go in the water the first time. And how do you coach them to get over that fear?
Yeah, I think it starts with the team. We train the team on how to teach swim instruction, how to identify safety issues in the pool, how to manage those issues. And then when it comes directly to the kids, our counselors, are pretty approachable. They're always available. They sit with each class to start and talk about the safety. They ask kids to raise their hand, how many people have swam before, how many haven't swam, anyone afraid. We try to get to know who the kids are a little bit before we just have them go into the pool. And then we work in small ratios. So we may have a ratio of 1 to 2, 1 to 3 with our kids, so the staff isn't overwhelmed, and then the kid doesn't get lost. So it's pretty much a direct relationship with the swim instructors to build that confidence.
This is where we live. Today we're looking into disparities among swimming skills that minority children have, specifically 6 out of 10 African-American children in this country have low or no swimming ability. Half of Hispanic and Latino kids also do not have swimming skills. Also, the CDC finds that drowning is the second leading cause of death among children. And we wanted to learn more about programs to help children learn to swim. We're learning about LEAP today in New Haven. With us on the phone is Henry Fernandez, Executive Director of LEAP New Haven. I wanted to learn more, Henry, before we take some calls on access to pools. Albert mentioned that at one point there was a pool that was closed. You were able to reopen it. But when if we're looking at the city of New Haven, where are the pools? And again, if families don't have, enough income to pay for lessons, your organization allows children to learn to swim for free. But I'm just curious about access. If you guys weren't there, where would they go?
Yeah, I think there's some small but important swimming programs in the public schools. So New Haven is somewhat unique as a city in that we don't have outdoor public pools. Our public pools are our publicly owned pools are in the school buildings. And so what's good about that is it means that they can be accessible year round. What's unfortunate about that is if you are going to a school that either doesn't have a pool or has a pool but doesn't have swim instruction, you don't have access to actually learning to swim. So the pools then become open for free swim during the summer, and paid lessons year round. So for us, our children, 85% of the children that we work with receive free or reduced lunch, which is a key indicator of poverty. And so paying for swimming pools, paying for access to swimming pools, or paying for lessons is out of reach for most of the families that we work with, and if they had to pay. There are private pools. There's certainly Yale University, and they have paid instruction. But generally it's only open to people who are affiliated with the university. And then we have a lawn club in town that has a beautiful pool as well. And that obviously is only open to members of the club, which is quite expensive. So all the things that your first speaker, the professor, talked about really rang true. The thing I would say, too, is I think Elvert does a really amazing job working with parents, because as the professor said, there's a lot of negative experiences with pools and simply that a lot of parents don't know how to swim. And so they're not passing that onto their kids unless they have access to a program like LEAP. And Elbert does a great job of talking with parents and overcoming some of those barriers, building their comfort. And I think that's really important, too, that as a community organization, we at LEAP recognize that there have been these historic disparities, and our staff does a really great job of working past those with parents, most of whom really want their kids to swim, but they're also bring their own fear. And finally, recently, the team started Adult Swim because so many of those parents were bringing their kids to swimming at LEAP would say, I should really learn to swim too so I can help my kids in the water. And so we've begun adult swim classes at night as well.
Elbert, how are those adult swim classes going?
They're great, and they're beginners just like their children. The fear is real. They're a little intimidated by the deeper end of our pool. But we let them know it's just a process. You know, it's going to take you coming for several swim sessions to build that confidence. But they have fun. And I guess the great part is they're not swimming with their kids. So all of their attention is focused in learning the instruction piece.
Before we take a call, I just wanted to ask, Henry mentioned that, Elver, you hear from parents about their own negative experiences with the water. Can you give us an example of what a parent has told you about why they may never have learned to swim?
Well, I definitely have one parent that comes to mind. They lost a relative swimming, and actually one of the kids actually knew that their cousin had passed away from drowning. And they already had that trauma. The kid didn't want to swim, didn't agree with the parents signing them up. But mom was like, look here, you know, we know firsthand the effects of not knowing how to swim. And we need to learn how to swim. And the key word she said was we. And in talking to these parents, you know, the desire for their kids to swim, they want to make sure that, you know, through their lives, you know, that this is one focus area where they develop.
You can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Linda's calling from Stony Brook. Linda, go ahead.
Yes. I'm listening.
Oh, Linda, it sounds like you're breaking up. Start over.
Okay. Sorry. Listening to the article and having grown up in the South, and the historical component of what the professor was discussing, with swimming, I remember very poignantly a time when I was a child and my mom was a swim coach and we had a summer swim team of going to a pool, and we had a handful of African-American swimmers on our team. And I remember the country club that we were competing against, they basically told us that all the swimmers of that were not African-American could participate in the program. And so that, I think, seeing that in the South and having taught lessons and also teaching adults how to swim as I got into college, we saw that disparity between, you know, people coming to the pool and historically almost seeing it as a place, just the hurts and the generations that that feeling of being excluded. And a big proponent of why, you know, parents and grandparents were not bringing kids to the pool, trying to get over that stigmatism. I think up here, what I've seen is you don't see that as much up in the North and up here in New York, which has been a really good thing. I do see in the South that communities are pushing because that dialogue has been there for a long time. And so that is very encouraging, access to more community pools and community programs to try to lessen that gap.
Well, Linda, thank you for your call. You know, we did reach out to historian Stacy Close in Connecticut because we were curious, too, about we hear so often about segregation in the South. We heard from author and professor Jeff Wildsey that segregation was just as bad in the North, and especially when we look at access to swimming pools. Stacy Close telling us that YMCA pools were initially off limits to African-Americans. And there was a specific case in Hartford in the 20s. Only after complaints did the Y give African-Americans access to the pool, and that was only on Sunday. We're also getting a tweet from a listener who writes, my entire family knows how to swim from great-grandparents on down. And she writes, FYI, black folks generally avoid boats and the water. So let's talk a little bit about that, Elver, what KG just said.
Hey, I'll be very honest. You know, I've been on vacation, I've traveled, and a lot of my friends, they don't want to go over a bridge. The fear that something may happen, they'll fall over. You won't take a cruise because of the water, and absolutely very, very fearful. Even if it's like 2 feet of water, 3 feet of water, you should feel like confident going in that. They don't. And it's just that lifelong. I haven't been in the pool. I haven't been in any kind of water. Why should I go in? And something's bad's going to happen.
Also in studio with us again is Nazir Peters, a sophomore at UConn, lifeguard and swim instructor at LEAP. You're younger than the rest of us, Nazir. Do you see that generational fear? Is it going away? Is it still there?
I could say I see it, but when we teach our adults, I can definitely see that fear going away from experience with teaching adults.
And Henry, before we head to break, we should mention that you receive grants to help with these programs, specifically from USA Swimming Foundation, also the Community Foundation Fund. Can you talk about those two streams that help you do the work that you're doing?
Absolutely. So USA Swimming has been a great partner for a couple of years now, and actually helped train some of our lifeguards and swim instructors at kind of the next more advanced level as we consider maybe starting a swim team. And the Community Foundation has been particularly helpful in supporting our work with girls, particularly girls of color, in helping them to swim. And there's some unique issues that develop with particularly with African-American girls around what things that stop them from getting in the pool. So for young teenagers, as they're getting their period, concerns about body image, and also about getting their hair wet, kind of dealing with all of those issues, are things that we work closely. The young women who work for Elver spend time talking about all those issues with teenage and preteen girls so they can have greater comfort in the pool, and they can understand that all of those issues are can be pretty quickly dealt with and make it easy for them to enter the pool. And that's really supported by the Community Foundation Women and Girls Grant.
Henry Fernandez, Executive Director of LEAP New Haven, you're going to stick around with us for our next segment, but I want to thank Elbert Eden, LEAP's Youth Development and Aquatics Director, for coming in. Also, Nazir Peters, a lifeguard and a UConn sophomore. Thank you both for joining us today.
Thank you for having us.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Now, coming up, we're going to learn more about how the City of New Haven School District is working to prevent summer slide. What's that? You're going to find out more after the break, and you can join us too. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Swimming programs are one way to enrich children during summer months, but how do you keep them from losing what they've learned during the 10 months of school? Loss in achievement is known as the summer slide, and joining our conversation is Will Clark, Chief Operating Officer of New Haven Public Schools. Will, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So some of our listeners may have heard this term summer slide, others maybe not. So talk a little bit about what this means exactly.
Well, essentially, the summer slide is the absence of education for a couple of months in the summer, and the issue where the kids are not repeating the skills that they're learning in the classroom on a daily basis for the 10 months of the school year, and with getting out of that practice and repetition that they may regress over the period of the summer and then come back in the fall, maybe a little bit further behind than when they left in June, and thus the first part of the school year is more catch-up and perhaps some lost time to then get back to where they were. So we're really intentionally focused on understand that issue, particularly in urban education, and try to put together summer programs and opportunities that offer kids the chance to both catch up for those who need some credit recovery and remedial work, but also just to keep kids engaged. Studies have shown that reading just six books over the summer, for example, can limit or eliminate any potential regression, and maintaining that sort of academic focus and practice and working on things, whether it's in a school program or some of the online tools we offer, we found can be really successful.
So give us an idea of what programs you're talking about. So we know that exercise is important. Also, you want to see them continue to read, but also being able to feed the children who rely on free and reduced lunch during the year.
Right. Those are great points, because for us, we have a big food insecurity issue, a big hunger issue here in New Haven and in most urban areas. We're very proud working with Congresswoman DeLauro and End Hunger and the state of Connecticut and many other partners here locally to have the largest summer feeding program in the state of Connecticut. We service sites, 80-plus sites. That includes food sites, but we've also expanded to a food truck and food buses, believe it or not, with our bus company that delivers meals to parks and places where kids are gathering. So we realize we can't just count on them coming to us. We've got to go to them as well. So we're very proud of expanding those efforts for breakfast, lunch, and now suppers, and also working with other partners to have food pantries at some of these locations as well. So we're feeding an 18 and under population with the way the summer meal program works, but then our partners at the food bank can offer opportunities for families and adults to get food as well. So kids can eat, adults can take some food home to make nutritional meals, and it kind of creates a nice win-win. That's something that's been worked on with our Food Policy Council and our Food Service Department and our Wellness Committee that we're really proud of. But to your point on the athletics, and I was listening into Henry and the work that LEAP has done, you know, we also know that kids need a break too, right? And, you know, just more school is not the first thing on their list of things to do in the summer. So we do try to package together with other partners, Police Athletic League, PAL, Schooner works and gets kids out on the water, the program, the Land Trust, Common Ground, a number of other partners that are doing a variety of camps. Our Parks Department has a number of camps. We have some that we can partner with, or we're doing some instruction during the morning, but then there's opportunities for the kids in the afternoon to do field trips and get outside and get their hands dirty and have some fun and open pools and things like that. So we're very cognizant of the need to service the whole child. So we want to make sure we're focused on reading and math and science opportunities, but also making it fun and having the opportunity for the kids to engage in free play as well as some organized and structured play. And one last one I'll just mention is that we do have expanded into, you know, very focused areas. So it's not just remedial, but higher end coding, math, and other programs that kids can sign up for based upon their academic standing. And so, you know, we go from, on the one hand, helping with remedial and credit recovery support, to the other hand, you know, building robots and engaging in higher-end math skills and things to really cultivate those students' coding and computers that are pushing for that next level as well.
Will Clark is Chief Operating Officer of New Haven Public Schools. Henry Fernandez is also with us, Executive Director of LEAP in New Haven. This is, again, a nonprofit organization that supports some of these programs to help children retain some of the what they've learned during the school year. But also, it's important to have fun, Henry, and not all kids have parents that can send them to summer camp. Tell us a little bit about some of the fun programs that LEAP is working on with New Haven kids.
Absolutely, and I'd be remiss if I didn't point out, too, that we couldn't run our summer programs without just an amazing partnership with Will and the New Haven Public Schools, both because they provide five school buildings for us, that we have about 100 kids at each of those school buildings, and then Will mentioned the feeding program, and we're a feeding site ourselves at our community center, and then our kids make use of the feeding program when they're on field trips, but also in the schools. So we run a literacy program very much focused on what Will talked about, making sure that kids are reading every day. And so our morning summer camp, the mornings of our summer camp, our camp runs from 8 to 4 every day. The mornings are focused on literacy. We have a whole bunch of activities that college and high school students do with younger kids. And then the afternoons are focused on things like swimming. We do a lot of overnight camping with kids. We have a great project with the Peabody Museum at Yale around teaching natural sciences to kids. We visit all the museums. We do the New Haven Public Library has been a great resource. We get our kids around, all around the city, to all the amazing activities that are in the city through a wonderful partnership with the State Department of Transportation. But the key thing here is that school that, you know, we want kids to not think of the summer as school. So while we sneak in a lot of literacy work and make sure that they read about 12 books on average during the summer, in addition, having all these fun athletics and artistic and exploratory activities is really important, whether your kid's in a program like LEAP or just if you're trying to figure out what your kid should do this do during the summer. A lot of things that they can't do, they just don't have the time to explore during the school year.
Well, I want to thank Henry Fernandez, Executive Director of LEAP in New Haven. Thanks a lot, Henry.
Thank you very much.
Thanks
for having us.
Thanks to Will Clark, Chief Operating Officer of New Haven Public Schools. I'm Lucy Nalbathanchel. It's been 2 years since I began hosting Where We Live. I couldn't do it without a great team. Lydia Brown, Carmen Baskoff, and Kion Wolf. And you, the listener, thanks so much for joining us 4 days a week and listening to our podcast. Thanks again, and have a great weekend.